Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate you all taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with us live, I'd like to invite you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. Paul's already there setting up the tables. So if you want to come on and join Paul in the chat room, we'll be monitoring that during the course of the show. So if you have some observations you would like to share, or if there's a question you would appreciate if we could fold in during the course of the show, if you put it in there, we'll be able to see it. And if all possible, we'll try to include your question in the next hour. And if you got a run off, as always, you won't miss a thing. If you've made the effort to go ahead and subscribe on iTunes, Spreaker, or any of the other aggregators of podcasts out there, this will be up tonight, and every Midrats will be available for you. So in case you do miss one of our shows, you really won't, because it'll be waiting for you when your schedule allows. And let's go ahead and dive into today's show. You know, when you look at, we've talked about it a fair bit for the last few months, and we're going to talk about it again. But five presidents in the last 20 years over both political parties have been involved in the conflict in Afghanistan that ended back in the end of August at the Kabul airport. People in the executive branch, Department of Defense, Department of State, Congress, media, and also the usual well-credentialed folks in the opinion space, a lot of them said they were shocked or surprised or otherwise not prepared for what happened. But you got to think, should they have been? There's two decades of people who have served in Afghanistan and have been tracking it, and a lot of them have been noting and warning from the beginning what could actually happen. What we're going to do today is we're going to look at those primary sources, those that have been in government for a while, especially in the military, know what the sometimes comically labeled lessons learned are, and also the folks from the Army Historical, Naval Historical Center. They go through and they interview the primary players, so you have that first-person account of history for people to go later on and to actually see how things happened in real time from people having that experience in that time and place. And we have one of the first iterations, I think, of that. And our guest for the full hour today, his timing was just great with this book, and he's going to be with us for the full hour. That is Craig Whitlock, staff writer for the Washington Post since 1998. He is presently assigned to the investigative desk, where he specializes in national security. And today we're going to discuss his recent book that came out in 2021, just last year, titled The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the World, published by Simon & Schuster. Craig, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And kind of to kick things off, and how I mentioned in the intro, that there are lots of Afghanistan books that are out there and that will be coming out, written from a variety of perspectives. Some of them focus on the political players. Some will focus on this senior uniformed leader or that. They may use secondary sources or just be flat-up opinion or observations, or maybe even people just telling their own personal story. But what I would recommend to the listener, especially those that served in Afghanistan, whether you were there from the very beginning or you just popped in halfway through or towards the end, is take a look at the book you've written, Craig. It's the fact that it is organized around a framework, but the framework is the research that you did from the lessons learned, mostly from U.S. Army, I believe, and also the historical interviews that were done with everybody from enlisted men, NCOs, company grade, field grade, general grade officers, and senior civilians, and even some of the worker bees at places like USAID. And if you could outline for a little bit when you started the process, how that works for an author to get into those archives, and how did you develop that framework? What was in your mind about what was the best framework that you could attach those documents you found most interesting into a very digestible book that could help educate the reader about what just happened in the last two decades?
Sure, that's a great question. I think you describe it really well. This is a book based on primary source documents. It's a book based on documents about what went wrong in Afghanistan over 20 years. And you're right, there have been a number of books, Afghanistan, lots of them, many of them very, very good. But there have been very few that have been written that sort of take a look at what happened over really two decades. Part of that is, of course, it's really difficult to get your arms around the longest war in American history and tell that whole story in a chronological fashion. That's what I sort of tried to do on this, but again, it was based on documents, and that's the framework, that's the structure. It's not a perfect history. It's not a comprehensive history of the war. It's not even a military history per se. It's really a history of what went wrong based on these primary source documents. And I'll describe them a little bit more to you. Some of them are, there were hundreds of oral history interviews that the U.S. Army conducted out at Fort Leavenworth. Army historians with a program out there, their strategic studies program, where they had usually mid-level officers coming through Fort Leavenworth for professional military education, mostly Army, but also Air Force, Marines, and some Navy officers. And when they would come through Fort Leavenworth, the historians there would sit them down, and whether they had been in Iraq or Afghanistan for about 15 years, they would, you know, turn on a tape recorder and ask them a list of questions. And those are unclassified interviews. Most of these were, when they were typed out, anywhere from 5 to 20 pages. But they were a really terrific resource. These were people who had served there from 2001 up to about 2015 or 2016. And the value to me as a journalist was that if I go in and I ask to interview somebody who's a reporter from the Washington Post, you know, people by and large, it's sort of human nature, they're going to be careful, right? They're going to watch what they say because they know it might end up on the front page of the Post or in coverage elsewhere. And so they're going to be a little bit careful in the back of their mind. They're going to be thinking, am I going to get in trouble for saying this? Do I need to tone it down a little bit? And in these oral history interviews, what I found is, you know, some people toned it down, but by and large, the people interviewed were really forthright about their experiences in Afghanistan. Like I said, these were unclassified interviews, and they were told they had to do them, but they were told that these were authorized. They wouldn't get in trouble with their commander or their boss or down the line. This was all part of an official process. So what I found is a lot of people kind of let their hair down and were pretty direct about what went wrong in Afghanistan. So that was a great resource. And even if I'd interviewed those people myself, I don't know that I would have gotten quite the depth of honesty and criticism of what happened over there. There are several other batches of primary source documents. Some of them were oral history interviews that the University of Virginia's Miller Center for the Study of the Presidency had conducted with senior George W. Bush administration officials. The Miller Center is a great resource for oral histories of various presidential administrations. They usually interview people, but they don't make them public till years later. These are real historical documents. And fortunately, the Miller Center just started to make its interviews with senior Bush administration officials available starting in late 2019. So I was able, even though the subject matter ran the gamut of the Bush administration's issues, there were a lot in there about Afghanistan. So I got to talk to, you know, see the interviews and listen to the interviews with some commanders, ambassadors, White House officials. And so that gave a different window into some senior decision-making. Again, these were people who were speaking for the historical record, so they tended to be a little more blunt than they would have been had they been interviewed on Sunday morning TV talk show or something like that. But really the biggest and most helpful batch of documents were, you know, what were called lessons learned interviews that were conducted by a little known federal agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. And that's kind of a mouthful. Their acronym is SIGAR, S-I-G-A-R. This was an inspector general that was set up by Congress back in the late 2000s to monitor fraud, waste, and abuse in Afghanistan. So they're really a bunch of auditors and investigators that follow the money and see if the money is being spent well or not. But around 2015, the inspector general started to do a different project, a side project that they called Lessons Learned. And at that time, the assumption was the war was winding down. President Obama had promised that he would end the war, pull out all U.S. troops by the end of his second term. So the thinking was the war was in its last stages, and this was a good time to interview people who were involved from all facets of the war from 2001 up to that point to get their idea of what went wrong so that if the United States ever found itself in another difficult conflict halfway around the world, maybe it could draw some lessons from it. The Inspector General, strangely, kept a lot of most of these interviews under lock and key. And this gets back to the beginning of the story of how I got started on this whole project. I had just moved from the Pentagon beat at the Washington Post to our investigative desk in the summer of 2016. And you'll recall that, you know, of course, there was a lot of attention being paid to the presidential campaign between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And one person who was getting some attention at the time was Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. You know, he was campaigning for Donald Trump. He had spoken up very publicly at the Republican National Convention, and he was getting a lot of attention in the political sphere. I had known Flynn a little bit, mostly by reputation, from when he served in the Army as the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and in particular when he was head of U.S. and NATO intelligence in Afghanistan. Anyway, I'd gotten a tip that Flynn had given a long, very critical, blistering interview to the Special Inspector General for its Lessons Learned program about the war in Afghanistan. And given his newfound prominence, I really wanted to know what he had said. I'd heard that this was an unclassified interview. He had been very critical about the war, how it had been handled from a policy perspective. So I've given, you know, the presidential campaign and the likelihood that he was going to have a high-ranking position under Trump, I wanted to know what he had said. And I approached the Inspector General's office and said, well, I'd like, you know, I'm a reporter with the Post, and I'd like to have a copy of this interview that I understand General Flynn gave. And at first the response was, sure, well, that shouldn't be a problem. We'll get back to you in a few days or a couple of weeks. Well, long story short, it took several months, and when Trump was elected and Flynn was immediately named Trump's National Security Advisor, the Inspector General decided this was not something they wanted to make public. They denied my request. And around that same time, I had found out that Flynn wasn't the only one who had given interviews to the Inspector General, that the IG had interviewed, you know, 300 or 400 other people who had been involved in the war, from generals and ambassadors to aid workers to Afghans to, you know, all sorts of people in sort of a what went wrong in Afghanistan project that they had been keeping mostly confidential. Long story short, again, the Washington Post had to go to court under the Freedom of Information Act. We had to file 2 lawsuits against the Inspector General in federal court to sue them, to compel them to release these unclassified documents, these notes and transcripts of these interviews they had done about the war in Afghanistan. It took us 3 years, but we finally were able to obtain most of those. And that led to a series I wrote for the Washington Post back in December 2019 that we called the Afghanistan Papers. And that series was based solely on these lessons learned interviews from the Inspector General, as well as a few other documents we had gotten, memos that former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had written about the war. But based on the very strong public reaction we had gotten to that series, people were pretty angry at a lot of the revelations contained in them, particularly these admissions by senior U.S. officials that they didn't know what they were doing in Afghanistan, that they didn't have a strategy. There was a lot of confession that things were really screwed up. When people read this in black and white in the Post, we had a pretty strong public reaction. So in response to that, we decided to write a book. So that's the long story, the long-winded story of how I came to write this book, The Afghanistan Papers. And while the genesis of it really was this tip about Michael Flynn and his interview, that really led me over the course of 5 or 6 years to recognize that, you know, we really did need to write a history, write a book based on the simple question of what went wrong in Afghanistan. And we were going to base that entirely on documents, on primary source documents, most of them oral history interviews, but also other unclassified memos, correspondence, diplomatic cables, you name it, to really curtain on what went wrong in these admissions of people who were involved in the war, of their own criticism of what happened.
Yeah, I was telling Sal earlier that unlike the Vietnam War, which I got to be a participant, this war was not started by deception. The deception came after it got started, and a lot of them were not, I mean, obviously they're not the same kind of deceptions as some of the stuff that happened for Vietnam, but they're the question, you know, that the thread that you just identified, the thread that runs through your book, which is people asking a common military question, actually, what are we doing here? Why am I here? What are we doing? And I mean, I think General McNeil started that, you know, asked that at some point. I think everybody else, maybe with the exception of some of the people who are still involved in the military, were asking those questions. Kind of go through how we got, and that's probably a politically incorrect term, but how we got into this into the tar baby phase of what started out as what I would have considered a punitive expedition to punish the Taliban, go after Osama bin Laden, and I thought Rumsfeld was saying we were going to get out early, but where did we morph into the tar baby or Venus flytrap world of getting caught in the web here?
Well, and that's a really good question. That's worth examining, re-examining, because even people who were paying close attention, I mean, they sort of go back and they think 20 years later, how did it turn out like this? And when you go back to 2001, of course, this war was completely different from Vietnam in the sense that this was a war of self-defense. The United States had been attacked by Al-Qaeda with these horrible terrorist attacks in New York and Washington and the plane crash in Pennsylvania. And, you know, there was really strong public support to protect our country, to go to war against Al-Qaeda, and the threat came from Afghanistan, even though the hijackers themselves were not Afghans. You know, they were, most of them were Saudis, and a lot of the plot had been hatched in Hamburg, Germany by the Hamburg cell and by the hijackers once they came to the United States. There was no question that Al-Qaeda's leadership, in particular, bin Laden, were the ones who had conceived and ordered these terrorist attacks. And there was real fear back in 2001, real fear that, you know, this was just the start of more to come. So, you know, by and large, the population of the United States was extraordinarily supportive of President Bush and Congress's decision to authorize the use of military force to go to war in Afghanistan. And the goal back then seemed pretty clear. The goal back then was to destroy Al-Qaeda and at least prevent it from carrying out a repeat of 9/11. But pretty soon into the war, things got a little murky because the war turned out pretty, you know, within the first few months, the results were pretty good. Within the first 6 months, by March or April of 2002, Al-Qaeda's leadership had either been killed, captured, or had fled Afghanistan. Bin Laden, of course, fled to Pakistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the second in command, also fled probably to Pakistan. Others had gone through Iran, but you know, a few had gone to Iraq. But really, there was no al-Qaeda presence left to speak of in Afghanistan in the spring of 2002. And in those early months of the war, President Bush and Rumsfeld, as you mentioned, had been asked repeatedly by journalists and lawmakers. They said, you know, what are you going to do to make sure we don't get stuck or bogged down in Afghanistan? You know, is this going to turn into a quagmire like Vietnam was? And both Bush and Rumsfeld were, well, Bush took the question seriously. I think Rumsfeld was dismissive, but they both said, no, we've learned our lessons from Vietnam. We also learned our lessons from what happened to the Russians in Afghanistan. We know that these great powers that go into Afghanistan, like the Russians or the British in the 19th century, you know, that they get into trouble, and we're not going to repeat that mistake. That's what Bush said in April of 2002 in a speech at the Virginia Military Institute. He was trying to be as reassuring as he could to say, we're not going to get stuck there, even though at that point al-Qaeda's leadership really had been gone. And part of the reason was Bush and Rumsfeld said, we're only going to keep a few thousand troops there, as many as we need to sort of prevent a collapse of the economy, or, you know, there were millions of refugees. There was real worries about what would happen to Afghanistan if we left right away. But the other thing that I think to this day people misunderstand or maybe have a faded view of is, at first, it was unclear if Taliban was the enemy or not. You know, there was no question that al-Qaeda was the enemy. Al-Qaeda was the reason we went to Afghanistan. The Taliban had certainly given support to bin Laden, had enabled al-Qaeda to use Afghanistan as a haven for the planning and carrying out of the 9/11 attacks. Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, had refused to give up bin Laden before the war started. You know, I'm not trying to say the Taliban were a bunch of innocents, but, you know, the Taliban weren't behind 9/11, and they weren't even the stated enemy at first. When Bush announced to the United States public in October of 2001, when he announced the war had started, he said the goal is to destroy al-Qaeda and to degrade the military capabilities of the Taliban. So he didn't even say the goal then was to remove the Taliban from power or to eliminate the power. The goal was to really reduce their capabilities so they could no longer, their country, Afghanistan, could no longer serve as a launching pad for another international terrorist attack. Of course, the Taliban ended up getting removed from power by December of 2001. At that point, I think U.S. officials thought they had kind of melted away into the mountains and they would never come back. But over the years, as the war slowly heated up again and the insurgency came back, that's where these lines started to blur, that who was the enemy? Was it al-Qaeda? Was it the Taliban? Were they other insurgents? And that's something that I was struck by in reading these oral history interviews, that even in those early years, in 2001, 2002, 2003, the troops who served in Afghanistan had a really difficult time defining who the enemy was. They kind of lumped them all under one term. They were terrorists. They were the enemy. But they were really just, they would describe them as the guys who were shooting at us, the bad guys. That was a phrase you'd hear again and again in these interviews, that where are the bad guys? Show me the bad guys. Well, of course, in Afghanistan, you know, they're not wearing uniforms, right? The insurgents, the Taliban, al-Qaeda, these guys don't, you know, they don't wear uniforms. They're insurgents. They're guerrillas. And this was a problem we had from the get-go. We never really could define who the enemy was. I mean, Americans understood that al-Qaeda was the enemy, but what about all these Afghans that were fighting? So in the first few months, we were fighting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. But after that, for most of the, you know, 19 of the 20 years of war, in the longest war in American history, we were fighting a different enemy than the one we had set out to defeat. And that, I think, as much as anything, goes a long way toward explaining why the war lasted as long as it did, that inability to define the enemy or why we were fighting them and what we were hoping to accomplish.
That's one part of the book, Craig, that had me remembering a lot of things. Is I had a little minor role in the 5th Fleet AOR in the first few months of the conflict in late 01. And then I found myself actually in theater 7 years later, very different war in 08 and 09. And back in the first few months after 9/11, we thought we were on some type of maybe a punitive expedition. Maybe we'll chase some people down who are trying to escape Afghanistan to the Horn of Africa. We'll do a couple other things, but never would have thought we had wound up where we were. And I was always trying to figure out how we got there. And one thing that, that I've kind of boiled down to over the last few years, you bring up, comes up a few times in your book, because this really was a not just a U.S. operation, it was an international operations. U.S., NATO, which means what's going on in D.C. and what's going on in Brussels by people wearing suits, not wearing uniforms, because ultimately for both our NATO allies and for us, the uniforms just do what the civilians tell you to do and try to make the best of it. And you brought up a few times interviews of folks who are at the Bonn conference where everybody came in and decided that they knew what could be new in Afghanistan. And you also, from that came the lead nations where the Germans said, yeah, no problem. We can set up the we can set up the police. And the Italians said, hey, we've got a wonderful judicial system in Italy. We can help you there. And the Japanese said, sure, we can, you know, disarm illegally armed groups. As the military kind of drifted and thought and overextended its capability, how much access did you have to Department of State, NATO, USAID records similar to what you got from the Army that could tell how the civilian side of the house kind of helped us drift off of where we thought we were in the beginning?
Yeah, a great question, and pretty good access there. So the Inspector General for Afghanistan had conducted its lessons learned interviews not just with military personnel or retired military, but with State Department officials, with NATO officials, USAID. And so, again, this is not a comprehensive look, but, you know, these were hundreds of interviews, effectively oral history interviews with people who served various capacities in the war from 2001 through the end of the Obama administration. And, you know, that era really comes up again and again. You mentioned the Bonn Conference. And for people who don't remember, the Bonn Conference was held in the former West German capital in late 2001. This was around the time when the Taliban had been toppled from power. You know, pretty quickly it had surrendered or had retreated, more like it, from Kabul and Kandahar and its other strongholds. So there was this international conference that was hosted by the United Nations and supported by the United States, its NATO allies, but other, it was also attended by other regional powers in Central Asia, such as Pakistan. The Iranians had representatives there, the Russians. So this was a, you know, it wasn't a global conference, but there were an awful lot of actors with an, you know, an interest in Afghanistan who were there. And what they were trying to do is bring in the Afghan power brokers other than the Taliban to sort of set up a new, figure out how can we come up with a new constitution and governing structure for this country now that the Taliban's been removed from power? How can we set Afghanistan on a path to stability and security? And so you had a lot of different Afghan groups here. You had a lot of warlords that we had supported during the first few months of the war from the Northern Alliance. You had representatives of the former king, Zahir Shah, who had ruled in Afghanistan up till the 70s. You had other actions from Afghanistan that were favored by the Pakistanis or the Iranians and the Russians. And they were all met at this conference center, the Petersburg Hotel in Bonn, West Germany, over a few weeks, trying to sort of hammer out a consensus for how Afghanistan would be led and governed. And it was during that Bonn conference that Hamid Karzai was selected with input from the United States to be the interim Afghan leader. There was a roadmap set out for writing and adopting a constitution. But in all these interviews I read in these documents, there was a recognition years later that while on the surface it seemed like the Bonn conference was a great diplomatic success, in retrospect, in hindsight, it was fatally flawed because there was one group that was not allowed to come to the table to discuss the future of Afghanistan, and that group was the Taliban, were Taliban sympathizers, because the thinking at the time, particularly among the Bush administration leadership and Donald Rumsfeld, was that, you know, the Taliban had no future in Afghanistan, that they had been vanquished. And Rumsfeld in particular equated the Taliban with Al-Qaeda. He called them terrorists. And when he would be asked in public, you know, are you not going to bring the Taliban back into the fold somehow, he would say, no, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And certainly I think that was understandable at the time, because the assumption was the United States had won a clear and clean victory in Afghanistan in just a few months. The Taliban had ceased to fight. So why negotiate with your vanquished enemy? But what a lot of the diplomats and aid workers and other civilians who were involved in the Bonn Conference and involved in Afghanistan just for years to come said the mistake was you couldn't really vanquish the Taliban. They had put down their arms for the moment, but they were, unlike Al-Qaeda, the Taliban was really part of the fabric of Afghan society. There were a lot of Afghans who were sympathetic to the Taliban, that even though this was such a brutal Stone Age group in many, many respects, there were many Afghans who really despised the warlords from the Northern Alliance. They saw them as very corrupt. And the Taliban, of course, were mostly Pashtuns, which was the dominant ethnic group in Afghanistan. So I think this gets back to the lessons learned, was that the United States really didn't understand Afghan society, didn't understand Afghan politics, and it made this hubristic error of thinking that it had vanquished the Taliban at that time, and it assumed that they were terrorists just like Al-Qaeda. And so at the time, there was some indication that if the Taliban had been invited to send representatives to the Bonn Conference, that they might have kept put their arms away for good, that they would have bought into this new political system, and we wouldn't have had an insurgency. Now, realistically, I think that would have been difficult to pull off. It wouldn't have been easy by any measure, but it wasn't even attempted. And so that really, that was the first major diplomatic error that laid the groundwork for this insurgency to come back in the ensuing years.
Yeah, you just hit on something I was going to ask about, which was the failure to understand Afghan society. And I guess my question really involves how much, when at some point we decided that we were going to make Afghanistan into little America, we were going to have it. They were going to have an army like ours that was trained along our lines. They were going to have a representative republic government of some kind. There were elections. We were going to build schools. At what point, you know, was this just a matter of people spending so short a time there, they never got a real feel for the Afghan people and what was going on, so that, you know, I think somewhere in the book you had a pretty good line about how every officer who served there ended up accomplishing something, at least in his fitness reports. At what point did this kind of reach almost a theater of absurd level where our failure to grasp the fundamental nature of the society causes us to do all kinds of useless, unnecessary, and quite expensive things?
Well, I don't want to overstate it, but this is going to sound strident, but I think it reached the theater of the absurd right away at the start, and it continued for 20 years. It never really let up. And in document after document, interview after interview, you see these and read these horror stories that, you know, these moments where you're either banging your head on the desk when you read it to hear about just how little we understood about Afghan culture, and we assumed that the American way was best, but we really didn't know what was going on. There was one long diplomatic oral history interview with a guy named Mike, who was a longtime Foreign Service officer. He had actually was one of the hostages in Tehran in 1979 when, you know, Khomeini's forces took our embassy workers hostage. He had, you know, served, you know, he was held hostage in Iran for over a year, and he, you know, became famous at that point. But he actually was one of the few Americans who could speak the local language, because he had served in Iran. He knew Farsi pretty well, which is Persian or what the Iranians speak, but that's very similar to Dari, which is one of the national languages of Afghanistan. So in 2002, he was asked to go help reopen the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, which had been shuttered for about 10 years. And he was one of only a handful of Americans, and I mean, you could probably count the number of people we had at the U.S. Embassy in 2002 on one hand who could speak any kind of local language, and Matrinko was one of them. And he said this was just such an obvious problem from the start that he would go, he put on his local clothes and he'd go hang out and have tea with some, local elders in Kabul. He'd get out of the U.S. Embassy compound on his own because he felt comfortable blending in. And he said even back then in early 2002, the elders in Kabul and other places where he'd go talk to them one-on-one or in groups, they would tell him, look, you Americans just don't know what's going on. All we have to do to get you guys involved in something is to say that, so-and-so is a member of the Taliban, and you guys run out, you open fire, and you try and kill them. And he said, you guys are just going to get sucked in to these conflicts that have been raging here for decades or centuries, that are ethnic conflicts or tribal conflicts or political conflicts, because you guys don't understand the way things work here. And we figured this out within the first few weeks. All we have to do is label somebody Taliban or Al-Qaeda and say, that's a bad guy. So Matrinko had been warning of this early on. He said, we're going to get in real trouble because we don't understand the place. But even though you think about it, we were there 20 years, you think the United States could have figured out a way to better understand Afghanistan. But even by the end, we barely had anybody who could the languages. And most of even though we had sent over 700,000 U.S. troops served in Afghanistan over those 20 years, many of them multiple times. But, most people would cycle in for 9 months or 12 months, and maybe they would go back every once in a while. But we never really gained any familiarity or expertise or understanding. When we did get General Flynn's long interview with the Inspector General, that was one of the things he brought up, that when he was oversaw military intelligence at headquarters in Kabul in 2009, 2010, he said even then, almost 10 years in the war, we had hardly anybody who could speak the local languages. We were all dependent on interpreters and translators. He did say there was one guy who was an Air Force colonel who had on his own decided to learn Pashto, one of the other major national languages. He had taught it to himself, learned it on his own time. By the time he came to military headquarters in Kabul, he was there for about 3 or 4 months, and the Air Force decided they needed to rotate him to his next assignment in Japan, right? And Flynn said he couldn't believe it. He's like, this is typical military bureaucracy. They've got to send him on to his new assignment, yet he's one of the few people who can speak the local language. This is supposed to be our national strategic priority here in Afghanistan. Why on earth are we sending this guy to Japan, right? But, the bureaucracy just kind of rolls on, and so we never really gained that familiarity in this country that we fought a war for 20 years, and it's kind of mind-blowing in retrospect when you think about it.
Yeah, that was a kind of a running joke when I was in Kabul in 08 and 09. There I was, a terminal 05 in my own little eddy of going nowhere. And I'd sit around with my fellow U.S. Navy guys who were there and a few of the other Army guys and the reservists. And we called ourselves the land of misfit toys, because it was clear, including us, that the best and brightest were not being sent. And I worked at a manpower job a few years earlier than that, where we were specifically told the following people will not go to Iraq or Afghanistan because that will hurt their careers. We need to make sure and take care of them by sending them to, a staff job in Japan or D.C. or something like that. But yeah, that's one part of the military culture that I see you got hold of, and it is frustrating. And sadly, we thought something might fix that, but it never did. And part of the military culture.
I just want to, if I can interrupt there, there's another good story in that
please.
Really illustrates it. There was a Army oral history interview that was done with Lieutenant General David Barno, and he was the commander of U.S. Troops during the Bush administration for about 18 months. By all regards, a very competent, capable, smart general officer. And when he arrived in Afghanistan, he had to reestablish a new headquarters in Kabul. And he said it was just pulling teeth to get any sort of people sent over from the United States. He said the Army in particular did him no favors. He'd use the word they failed me because they wouldn't send me the help I needed to staff, you know, headquarters in Kabul during the war, because he said, you know, if anybody was going to deploy who was any good, they were sent to Iraq, and it was just really difficult to get any help. He said he had to, you know, they had a joke. They had so many contractors or retired officers coming in to staff up that they called it the world's most forward deployed chapter of the American Association of Retired People. And, you know, again, you read this and you think back, you know, back, this is 2003, 2004, where we're fighting this war in Afghanistan. People still remember the trauma of 9/11, and yet we can't even staff up military headquarters in Kabul when the three-star general at the time is screaming, you know, I'm not talking about hundreds of people. He's asking for, you know, handfuls of people to come over. And to me, that really revealed a lot of that problem, that the bureaucracy really thought the war was over at that point, and it stopped paying attention because it was focused completely on Iraq or on other places.
I served with two officers, one major and one lieutenant colonel, who both retired in the 1980s, who were, you know, they did a couple of combat tours of Vietnam, and the Army was like, well, if you could pass the physical exam, we'd like to bring you back on. And you know, they were doing the best job that they could, but they were just filling that billet so, quote, more important, unquote, people could go do important jobs, CONUS. It was disappointing. And another part of military culture is somebody from who's been working it for a long time, but from the outside, that I know you've seen in other contexts, but it really comes out in glaring detail, primary sources. You don't even have to put the commentary because you quote the primary sources on it. And in the military culture, there is, I try to describe it as a multi-filtered effect of best case scenarios, that when you come up on something, there are two or three different explanations. The boss wants to hear positive news, so we take the most positive news. And that is compared against another story, and the most positive is taken out. So by the time it comes out the other end, it almost, even in real time, is disconnected what everybody sees. And it's not really lying, I guess, but it comes across as a type of a hyper-optimistic dishonesty that I guess sounds good to the person saying it, but to the audience is well disconnected from what everybody is seeing. How did you see that aspect of military culture manifest itself in the record as you dug through it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think this idea that the American people weren't getting a full and accurate picture of how poorly the war was going, you can really describe it in a number of ways. And I think the way you described it was one component of it, where when things get filtered up the chain of command, when bad news gets reported, it usually gets watered down. And we would see this in lessons learned interviews and oral history interviews and other documents where people who were serving in Afghanistan would admit this. They said, you know, there was one guy who worked at military headquarters in Kabul during the Obama years who said that, you know, the higher-ups just didn't want to hear the bad news. You know, they said, I mean, he was very blunt about it. He said, look, if we had some kids get run over by an MRAP, okay, and we had to report that, they could handle that. But if you said, look, we're losing Ghazni province, you know, they didn't want to hear that. So they had these color-coded maps to show who was controlling what districts. And, you know, inevitably the maps would get redrawn, recolored to show that things were moving in the right direction. And so the, you know, Flynn himself said this, the higher up the chain of command you went, the more watered down the bad news became. And I think some of that is sort of part of the culture, that there's this reluctance to report bad news because, you know, you want to show that you're doing your job, that you're having an effect. I mean, you know, as Eagle One made a referral this earlier, this was a problem when you had brigade commanders or battalion commanders in their units go to Afghanistan, they serve for 9 months or 12 months. And inevitably, when they go in, they all say, oh, my God, things are really screwed up here. They go on their right seat, left seat ride with the outgoing commanders or unit leaders, and They say, boy, this looks really bad. But they say their mission is to, you know, stabilize their area and do this and that. And inevitably, by the time those same people would leave, they would say they had accomplished their mission, right? That things were good. And then the next, they come in, the next guy comes in and they do the left seat, right seat ride with the next guy. And he goes, oh my God, this is really screwed up. And you just hit that same cycle again, because nobody wants to say they couldn't accomplish their mission or they couldn't accomplish the goals that were set out for them as leaders during their deployments. You know, some of that's human nature. Nobody wants to admit, look, we failed. We didn't accomplish this. We, you know, that the insurgency is getting worse. You know, who's going to admit that? Because both for career reasons, but also it's going to make their bosses look bad. So everybody would always say we accomplished our mission in 9 or 12 months, even though things were slowly but steadily getting worse all along. And so I think that really gets to the point you bring up about the culture of, you know, you kind of put a spin on it to make it look better than it is. But in doing the research for my book, I found that there was also, frankly, there were a lot of examples of just flat out lying and fabrication. And I don't use that word lying lightly. I know that's something that in political reporting is gets a lot of use, but you know, I'm pretty careful about it because you have to get to people's intent when you say somebody was lying. But we'd find example after example where things that were stated in public at the time were known by military officials not to be true. And I'll give you a couple examples of that. One, there was Vice President Cheney had made a trip to Afghanistan. I believe it was in February of 2007. The insurgency was getting worse, and Cheney flew in first to Islamabad to meet with the Pakistani dictator Pervez Musharraf to try and see if he could get him to crack down on the Taliban havens in Pakistan. Then he made an unannounced trip to Afghanistan, and he was landed in Bagram Air Base, and he was supposed to go meet Hamid Karzai in the presidential palace in Kabul, but there was snow, and so he got stuck at Bagram. And the next day, when Cheney was getting ready to go to Kabul to meet with Karzai, there was a suicide bomber who blew himself up at the front gate of Bagram and killed a bunch of people, including a couple Americans, a South Korean, and about 20 Afghans. And Cheney was at Bagram at the time, so this got a lot of attention. And at the time, Army headquarters, the head of public affairs and others came out and said, no, Cheney was never in danger. But not only that, they said Cheney wasn't the target. Even though the Taliban had said publicly, they immediately came out and said, we knew Cheney was there and we were trying to kill him. We sent a suicide bomber there. And back then in 2007, this was highly unusual to have suicide bombers in Kabul or Bagram. Taliban was really focused in the southern part of the country. So this was a real propaganda coup for them to say that they were able to send a suicide bomber, you know, to the gates of the main American base in Afghanistan while the vice president was there. But both in Kabul at U.S. military headquarters and even at the White House press secretary at the time, Tony Snow, they all denied that Cheney had been the target. They said there's no way that the Taliban even knew that Cheney was in the country, that he was perfectly safe, and this was just the Taliban lying. But in documents I obtained in my research, there was an Army oral history interview with an Army officer who was in charge of perimeter security at Bagram at the time. He was with the 82nd Airborne. And in his, you know, this is his Army oral history interview. So this is an official Army document. He gave a completely different story. He said, no, the Taliban absolutely knew Cheney was there. Word had leaked out. We knew about this. And in fact, the suicide bomber was only about 30 minutes away when Cheney was supposed to leave the base. He blew himself up. He said the suicide bomber saw some up-armored SUVs coming out of the front gate. They knew, you know, which you know it's some important people going in a caravan like that. So he had waited till then. He blew himself up. But this Army officer said, really, he just targeted the wrong caravan, that Cheney was supposed to leave about 30 minutes later. In fact, this guy said he was working with the Secret Service to protect Cheney that day, and they were really worried about the possibility that he could get targeted. And because of the weather, they couldn't fly him to Kabul to meet with President Karzai. So instead, they were getting ready to smuggle him in a gun truck, the vice president, as a decoy. So again, he said absolutely the U.S. military knew he had been targeted, and they lied in public about it. And you see example of like this throughout 20 years, where it wasn't just putting a spin on things or putting a happy face on how things were going. There was flat out dishonesty and lying about actual events that happened on the ground.
Yeah, I think some of the important part of your book has to do with the incredible amount of corruption that persisted in Afghanistan among the Afghans, as maybe more than, and was aided and abetted by a system that apparently did not rigorously investigate where the money was going. One of the questions I had for you, though, had to do with the speech that President Obama gave at West Point. Right as he was committing more troops, he set the first deadline for withdrawal from Afghanistan. What was your perception of the effect that had on, based on your interviews and stuff, on the war after that speech?
Yeah, this is really a pivotal moment in the whole conflict. This is, I believe it was December 2009, where Obama announces essentially he's going to surge up in Afghanistan after a long time he'd spent reassessing the strategy. And immediately there's a lot of conflict in his administration over this. Obama said, okay, we're going to have a total of 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, plus more from NATO. And this is part of this surge, similar to what we did in Iraq and under Bush. But he put a deadline on it. He said, I want to start pulling these troops back out again. I want to start the drawdown after 18 months. And, later on, he said he wanted to withdraw all U.S. troops by the end of his second term. And immediately, internally, there were others, particularly at the Pentagon and in the military leadership, in particular, General Petraeus and others, who thought that this was, this was putting them in an untenable position, because you're announcing to the enemy, who at that point was widely believed to be the Taliban, that you're going to leave soon, and so all they have to do is wait you out. At the same time, Obama and his political supporters, said they didn't want to get stuck in an open-ended conflict, that they were really afraid of getting bogged down indefinitely in Afghanistan, so he wasn't going to send 100,000 troops to Afghanistan without any sort of expectation of when they might come back, that he wasn't going to commit to this open-ended conflict. So internally, there was a real dispute over this. And of course, the military, says, aye, sir, and says they'll carry out Obama's orders, which they did. But I think there was, in the interviews and the documents I obtained, it was very clear that there was real disagreement over this. And there were predictions that Obama's strategy wouldn't work because of it. And I think those are all legitimate criticisms. Certainly the Taliban knew that the Americans were going to leave. And so this, not only did they just have to wait them out, but it also didn't put any pressure on them to kind of try and negotiate any sort of peace deal with the Americans or with the Afghan government. At the same time, I guess, after all the research I'd done and we were there for 20 years, I'm certainly sympathetic to Obama's point that he didn't want to get stuck in an open-ended war, that he was really afraid that he was going to send more and more people to Afghanistan. Is this going to look like Vietnam? Or are we just going to get stuck there in this cycle to send more and more troops for longer and longer? And certainly history bears out those concerns as well, which again kind of brings up the fundamental question of, was the surge a mistake? Was this doomed from the beginning? And I think that's something that historians are just kind of coming to wrestle with now, that maybe that whole strategy that Obama and his generals supported just didn't make much sense. Maybe we needed to have withdrawn much earlier instead of sending 100,000 troops, that the goals and objectives weren't really clear at that point with what we were trying to accomplish 10 years into the war, and that maybe this wasn't a winnable conflict and we should have cut our losses 10 years ago instead of waiting till 2021.
I almost think that, in addition to diplomats and military theorists, and this sounds like a sarcastic comment, but I'm serious as a heart attack. that some industrial psychiatrists should probably come in and look at it, that how we could do this for 2 decades and have the results we did. And there were a variety of places you could clearly see in your book, and I think you framed it very well without having, bolded and underlined and highlighted, that there were certain inflection points. And there were also some very poignant points that really, I thought, break out in stark relief a lot of the issues I still don't think we have a firm grasp on. And one of them is, in some ways, there's kind of an institutional inertia that we found ourselves there. And I think somebody who has a visual at the end, when General Miller steps off the airplane at Andrews Air Force Base and hugs it out with SecDef Austin, is kind of an interesting visual. But there's another visual that I was not aware of. I was hoping to get your view of. And when General Scott Miller was in front of, I believe it was the Senate during his confirmation hearing, he had his son, who was a second lieutenant, right behind him, and a peer of my children as well, which kind of gives a stark overview of the length of that war. Yeah, how did that image, as a reporter, as somebody that works with ideas and words and visuals, how did that particular point in your book kind of bring out a few issues in relief?
Yeah, that was a really important time when Miller was, you're right, it was his confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee. I think this was, may have the year wrong, but I think it was the summer of 2017. And this was one of the questions for him was, almost predictably, at that point we were 16 years in the war. How are you going to bring this thing to an end? How are we going to get out of there without egg on our face? How can we stabilize Afghanistan for the long term? Are we, this is an awful long war. And Miller pointed to his son, who was second lieutenant, and said, look, I have a stake in this. And Miller had, of course, he was in special operations, and he had served in Afghanistan off and on for many years, getting back toward the beginning of the war. And he said, not only have I served there, but look, I've got a son with skin in the game. I don't want to get stuck there either. And it certainly is an understandable point. At the same time, that raises all sorts of complex questions, because we did have a number of people in the military, particularly in the Army, who had played a leadership role in the war for many, many years. And you mentioned General Austin, Secretary Austin, and he had served in Afghanistan briefly back in 2003 as the acting commander. And certainly when he was this commander of U.S. Central Command, before he became defense secretary, he was responsible for what was going on in Afghanistan. So he had a long record of oversight and responsible for what happened there. Others include General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He had served in Afghanistan off and on since the beginning. He was one of the officers who helped stand up the training program for the Army, Afghan Army and Army police forces way back in 2003-2004. And he was also a commander who over the years was kept saying in public that we were going to win, we were going to win the war. And yet, so we had a lot of leaders who were responsible for the war in differing capacities over 2 decades. And these were most often leaders who were reluctant to withdraw. Austin and Milley and Miller, none of them were saying we need to cut our losses and get out of here. This is an unwinnable conflict. They kept arguing that we need to stay. We need to, we need to stick it out. We need to do more to knock the Taliban back. We've got to come up with a settlement. We've got to stand by the side of our friends in the Afghan government. And frankly, they probably would have, if they were in charge or they made the decision, we'd still be there. And so these are some questions that I think our uniformed services over time are really going to have to wrestle with. Their role, even though the civilians were making the decisions on strategy and troop withdrawals and deployments, they were getting their advice from people in uniform at senior levels. And the advice by and large over 20 years was to continue or expand the conflict with this idea that we could accomplish certain goals. And in retrospect, that seems hard to defend. And I think, again, this is something we'll be wrestling with for years and decades to come.
Yeah, Craig, I think hubris is probably the right word for some of the reasons why we did not get out sooner. And but be that as it may, we've taken up a lot of your time. I think that your book is a really good read. I think the fact that the most disturbing is that throughout, as I said earlier, the thread was that we had no, after a certain point, there was no strategy. We were just making it up as we went along, and it looked like, and thinking that we could make it better somehow. Be that as it may, what are you working on next, and where can our listeners find that information?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because as of today, I'm banging away on my next book, which is a case you guys probably have heard of a little bit, I know, which is about Fat Leonard in the U.S. Navy. And that's a case I've been following for a number of years at the Washington Post. I've been working on a book for a few years. I'm writing it now, wrapping it up, and hopefully it'll get published next year. And I know that case has gotten a lot of attention, but let me just say that it's, even to this day, it's far worse than anybody knows in terms of the number of people swept up in it and just how much damage this inflicted on the Navy and its leadership. And it's kind of a jaw-dropping case that I've spent a number of years trying to get my arms around. So that's going to be my next book, and it'll be out next year.
Well, that sounds, knowing the research that you put into this book, Craig, I'm looking forward to that, because I know we're gonna find some stuff that people haven't seen before. And again, for the listeners, our conversation today with Craig Whitlock is based upon his book, The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. If you're looking for primary sources, that's put in a real good framework, I can't recommend it enough. Craig, congratulations on your book. I hope for its continued success. And, yeah, Fat Leonard's the gift that keeps on giving for everybody. Hope you have a great year. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you both for having me. Really enjoyed it, and thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Yes, thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly.